You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome to the Open Society Foundations. Thank you all so much for coming. It's an honor to have you here, especially the Honorable Princeton alumni here. But it's mostly a pleasure to have the Collateral Repair Project here with us tonight. I'd like to thank Monica and Amanda, who will be coming. Oh, here she is, for being here. Again, we are really honored to host and to associate ourselves with you guys. Thank you so much and welcome. Monica?
All right, so thank you, Daniel, for that introduction, and thank you also for hosting us here today. So I've been with CRP now since 2013, and it's my privilege to introduce Amanda Lane to you. Amanda's been in Jordan for a very long time and has been CRP's director since 2013. Before that, she's had a long career in international development in Jordan, in Africa, and also has worked with nonprofits in the U.S. Amanda is a friend and a mentor of mine and a fantastic speaker, so she'll you've got a treat in store for you tonight. And a little bit about CRP as well. CRP is a really special organization. It's sort of unique in its space in Jordan, and Amanda will tell you more about that. Something I want you all to keep in mind, too, is that this is a very complicated situation and there's a lot going on, and we really encourage you to ask questions. So Amanda will have a presentation, but we'd really like for this ultimately to be a real discussion. So Amanda is ready and equipped to answer your questions and excited to do so. So I think with that, I'll hand it off to Amanda.
All right, good. Thanks for coming out. Wow, it's great to see so many people out. I'm really pleased to be here and happy to talk to you. I am loath to take a whole lot of time going into great detail. Like Monica mentioned, I think it's hard for me because I've been living in Jordan for 7 years. I'm often not super plugged into what people's questions are. So I really, I'm looking forward to any questions that you want to ask. I'm not planning to talk for very long. So I'm happy for us to get into nitty gritty, whether it's about the refugee experience in general, the situation in Jordan and primary host countries. I'm not super knowledgeable about all the primary host countries, but a fair amount about what's going on in Jordan. And then, definitely about the work that we're doing. So I kind of hate this. Can you guys see? You can see. Yeah. Okay, good. I just feel odd standing right in front of this the screen. All right, so the Syrian refugee crisis is now in its 8th year. And for most of us, it's something, I'm assuming, for most of us, it feels like something that we can barely get our heads around. We've got over 5 million Syrian refugees who have fled to the surrounding countries, and it's the biggest refugee crisis since World War II. So put a map up. This map is somewhat dated. It's probably the best one that I could find for a presentation. The numbers are actually bigger than what is here representing the primary host countries. What the latest numbers that we have in Jordan are: over 657,000 Syrian refugees, over 66,000 Iraqi refugees, just under 10,000 Yemeni refugees in Jordan, and this is the fastest growing refugee population in Jordan, as well as over 4,000 Sudanese refugees. We've got just under 1,000 Somali refugees, and another 1,600 refugees from other nationalities. So Jordan and other primary host countries like Lebanon and Turkey, they've been super generous in offering, accepting refugees. One in every 10 people in Jordan is a refugee. And in Lebanon, it's even one in every four people in Lebanon are refugees. It's been a real struggle for these countries to absorb them. So Jordan, for example, before the refugee crisis, was already really struggling with a stagnant economy, high unemployment, and Of course, over 700,000 refugees in Jordan is certainly exacerbating the situation. It's really key for you to know that refugees in Jordan are largely forbidden by law to work. So this is very much influenced by the very existing delicate situation that the government has to kind of engineer, you know, with the tribes and, you know, just a difficult economic situation. I won't go into great detail, again, about the Jordan context, but I'm really happy to answer any questions afterwards. But let's think about what we see in the media. So the news that we see about Syria in particular is nothing short of overwhelming. We've got horrific images just continuously coming. And I popped a few on my presentation. You've probably seen some of these. Some of these are quite well known and iconic images over the past 7-8 years. And then this was just from a couple of weeks ago. I know that I almost feel numbed by it all. You know, with the latest images like this pouring out from the recent chemical attack, and really all I can feel when I see images like this is deep, deep sadness. You know, this is just a sampling of what we've been seeing over the past 8 years. Death, destruction, and senselessness. So I imagine that you all probably feel like I do when you see these photos, when you see the headlines, when you feel inundated by all of this just negative news. I mean, the feeling that one gets from seeing this stuff is just utter helplessness. And I think it's because we feel like, you know, what could I possibly do in the face of so much death and destruction? How could I help? You know, how it's so big. And I feel, I don't know, I think about this a lot. Our world feels like such a scary place in many ways, where we have no idea what's going to pop up in tomorrow's headlines. It often feels to me like I think about it as if the world is just spinning out of control. And, you know, working with refugees every day, it's something that I'm constantly reminded of. And then added to that is a feeling of what on earth could I possibly do to make a difference? You know, it's just so huge. It's so big. So I'm wanting to focus on some of the great things that we're doing. I want to tell you about what we're doing in Jordan to help refugees that's beginning to make the suffering and the madness just might be spinning out of control, but just kind of stop for a moment and begin to start turning in the other direction. So let me tell you a little bit about my work. If you'd walk into our community center at Collateral Repair Project, you'd probably be really surprised by what you would see. You might walk into a room like this where you would see refugee women quietly offering up acupressure for trauma to other refugee women. Or you might hear people burst into laughter in an English class because somebody's pronounced a word funny, which is quite common, very common to see. Or you might see a bunch of little kids running around, shrieking with laughter at after school club. We have a lot of happiness and a lot of joy at our center, which makes it really lovely for me to come to work every day. Have a lot of happiness and joy, but it's really in stark contrast to the extreme struggle that these families we're serving are facing every day. People who are coming to our center have fled violence in their home countries, and they have nowhere else to turn. They need to get out fast, and they need to take whatever small amounts of money that they have with them and whatever items they're able to carry with them. Once they get to Jordan, they rent a small apartment, and within just a few months, they're out of money. We go into homes where it's really common for families to be sleeping on tile floors, living in completely bare houses, and with no food to eat. And I threw in a few slides. I mean, this is very common. Like, sometimes people don't even have these thin little mattresses. And it, you might not know, but it gets very cold in Jordan. So many people don't have heaters. Houses are uninsulated. They're stone. It's cold and very miserable. A lot of water damage. We have very wet winters, just really difficult living conditions. Here's another kitchen. So as I mentioned, it's illegal, or it's not allowed for Jordan, not allowed for refugees in Jordan to be able to work. And so that means that they're unable to take care of their basic needs. So putting food on the table, paying for their rent, ensuring that their kids are able to go to school. And that's how these people first find us. They're desperate to find ways to feed their families. That's what we do at Collateral Repair Project. We help people with what they need. We're a grassroots organization. We're operating on a shoestring, and we really pride ourselves in getting aid to where it's needed most in a really precise manner, so precisely to where it's needed. We see our community center as a one-stop shop where people can come in, get their basic needs taken care of, and then they can begin attending various activities that give them opportunities to gain new skills, begin rebuilding the communities that they've lost, and begin to heal from trauma. A couple of slides here. This is the exterior of our building. We're located in East Amman in a neighborhood called Hashemi Shemali, and it's really one of the epicenters of where urban refugees are living. So this is outside of the center, and then this is our living room space. So when people walk into our center, we don't have a desk. We're not like large organizations. We don't have a reception center. People just walk in and are hanging out. So we started up in 2006 with a huge influx of Iraqi refugees into Jordan, and we're continuing to serve Iraqis who continue to flee the sectarian violence that's still there. Since 2006, we've begun to serve Syrians, or since almost 8 years ago, we began to serve Syrians, and we're increasingly turning our attention to other refugee groups, so Sudanese, Somali, and Yemeni refugees. And their situation is worse than we've ever seen. All of this is in a current context where international organizations have come to help Syrian refugees, and they've spent the bulk of their funds in the refugee camps, where less than 20% of the Syrian refugee population is living. So after 7 years of war, international funding to help these refugees has continued to wane, and that means that more and more families who have been on monthly assistance are starting to get dropped off. So the organizations are no longer able to give them some kind of monthly stipend to help them get through the month. Minority refugee groups like Iraqis, Sudanese, Somalis, and Yemenis have really fallen through the cracks in a system that's been prioritizing Syrians. They're receiving less aid across the board, and they're unable to access the many programs that large NGOs are running that end up prioritizing Syrian refugees. So Collateral Repair Project is really unique in Jordan because we're assisting refugees based on need. We don't care where they come from, and all of our programs are open to all refugee groups, including Jordanians. Nearly all the refugee families that we meet for the first time are at their most desperate, and they need help. What they need most are things like food, mattresses, blankets, cooktop stoves, a heater, personal hygiene items, and we work really quickly to get them what they need. We're prioritizing food assistance over everything else, and this is a photo of, we have people coming in to get food vouchers. So these are food vouchers here, and once a month at the beginning of the month, families come in and get their food vouchers, very similar to the food stamp program in the United States. And they're able to go to a local grocery store and get what they need. We decided to prioritize food vouchers because we realized that the stress, the daily stress of not knowing where you're going to get your food, I mean, everybody's got to eat a couple times a day, it's a huge stressor. People are able to go, they're able to shop, for the month, get the food that they need. And it keeps them from, you know, the stress of figuring out how they're getting their food on their table. The food vouchers allow them to maybe not have to pull a kid out of school to beg on the street, or really, you know, have to struggle with anger management issues because of just the stress of trying to deal with that. So our food vouchers are feeding families, but they're also helping to protect them in many other ways. The images that we see stressing the large scale of the refugee crisis might be overwhelming, but really the reality is that we're able to help refugees on a very minimal budget. So with $50, we're able to feed a family of four for a whole month, or we can get a kid in school for a whole year. And that's really interesting because we have so many kids who are not in school because, you know, families typically have multiple kids. They're able to send their kids to the public schools, but they need a backpack. They need to have a uniform and they need to have school supplies. And so, you know, if you're unable to put food on the table, being able to, you know, pay for three kids to get into school is going to often be a deal breaker. So I'd like to move on to what I really want to tell you about, though. So getting food into people's bellies is just a really small part of what we do. It's an important first step. It's taking care of a critical need, but it enables people to begin taking part in our community center activities. And our community center programs are what really is exciting about what we do. They're creating a space for refugees to not only heal, but to begin to thrive. So I remember about 5 years ago when I was asked to take up this position. Our operations were a lot smaller. Monica was actually in Jordan with me, and it was kind of me and Monica and our one employee. CRP was mainly feeding people. We were offering a few classes here and there at our community center, but it was so apparent how the depth of trauma had just, you know, was everywhere in our community. Nearly every family has members who are suffering from trauma, PTSD, depression, high blood pressure is rampant, as is diabetes. And I remember thinking how overwhelming it was because, you know, we weren't psychiatrists or psychologists or therapists. We had this tiny budget and, you know, really weren't sure what we would be able to do. It was really hard because, you know, I wasn't sure how we were going to proceed. And what we decided to do at that point ended up being really interesting because it really ended up setting the trajectory of our work. And it enabled us to begin helping refugees in a way that I don't think I could have ever imagined. And this is what we did. It started with yoga classes. We started thinking, and we started thinking that it would make sense to help people find a way to get back into their bodies, to be able to help them to better connect with their emotional health, and to offer them ways to begin to be aware of and to engage with their stress. And we were really surprised to see so many men coming to our yoga classes. And they persisted, even though they would come in and they might be overdressed, wearing a suit, or, you know, coughing through the class or rushing out to smoke a cigarette or something right after it was out. But they kept coming. And here's a picture of some of our men doing yoga. And we realized that we were onto something. So we started beginning to open up new activities that we knew would help people begin to connect with their inner needs. So we started up a men's listening circle, a support group, we call it. We started up leadership training for women. We started small groups teaching mind-body techniques. And we also started activities where people could begin to interact and grow together. So we started up a really active after-school club and teen groups, family violence awareness and prevention discussion groups, and so much more. And something amazing started happening. We began to see people start to transform before our eyes. And I want to talk to you guys about, well, actually, I'm going to talk to you about a few people in particular, but starting with this guy, Isam. The first time that I saw Isam was about 6 months ago, and he walked up to me with difficulty. His body was very much like rigid, kind of turned in on itself, and he came up to ask me a question. He came up to ask me if it would be possible for him to get a food voucher, but I remember it was really hard to understand him. His speech was muddled, and it wasn't clear at all. I eventually understood what he was saying, but it was so clear to me that he was just struggling. I mean, it was not just his physical and those difficulties for him, but he just seemed so beaten down. And so I remember suggesting to him that he try out one of our men or our men's support group because it was happening that day. And again, that was about six months ago. But what has happened with Isam, like, I can't even begin to tell you. It's kind of amazing. What I know is that every time I see him at the center, I feel like he's just lit from within. He now carries himself with ease, no longer folded in on himself, and he speaks so much more clearly. And I have another picture of this is him here on the left. And so before I came on this trip, I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to see what's happened to you, Issam. This is amazing. And so he told me that before coming to CRP, he didn't have anybody to talk to or to laugh with. He's living alone. He's in Jordan alone. And now he feels like he belongs to a community. He says, I can say anything that's in my heart, and I'm doing a lot better. It's beautiful that I'm psychologically relaxed. He tells me that his stomach problems and his physical issues have really waned as well. He used to really rely on medication for his stomach, and he's really thriving, which is something that again and again, just I see and I find it amazing. He's one of so many people that I've seen become empowered and transformed through the close community that we're nurturing at CRP. I want to tell you about somebody else. This is Nadia. And maybe you've read about people like her. She's Iraqi. She's from a minority Christian group. And you probably didn't hear about when Nadia started attending a leadership group at the Women's Leadership Group at CRP. So this is a program that we have that gives women leadership skills, and it also helps them to take an active role in their own self-care. So I want to tell you what Nadia has to say in her own words, because I remember very clearly, like Issam, the first time that I saw her. She was had recently, it was a few years ago, she had been living in Mosul and had left because ISIS had come into her town. And when I first met her, she could barely make eye contact, just very, very traumatized. And that's not uncommon at all. But here's what she has to say. She says, my whole life, I didn't feel like I had any rights. We were living in fear, as a minority in particular. I got to the point where I hated myself, thinking, until what point will I stay afraid? I've hurt myself and my children with this fear. And so I came to CRP's center, and what can I tell you? It was like psychological treatment without a doctor. I got to know so many of the women who back in Iraq I would have been afraid of. She used to hide out in her home and not go out as a minority. I had no friends back home, but I came to CRP and I thought, where were these amazing people in Iraq? As a group, the Women's Leadership Group, we've built an unimaginable bond. And so here are a few pictures of Nadia at our center. This is her in the yellow, offering up acupressure to other refugee women. And then this is her in the jean jacket with other women who are part of our Women's Leadership Group. Nadia goes on to say, I convinced my daughter to come with me to CRP, and I saw her personally changing day by day. Do you know what a happy thing that is to see? That you've done something for your daughter that will impact how she'll go on to raise her own family. My daughter has now become a trainer in the Women's Leadership program, and I see her confident in herself now. Her thoughts and her opinions come out naturally and coherently without fear. She now has big dreams. And I threw in a photo of her daughter. This is Ru'a in the pink, leading one of the women's leadership sessions. And for me, I mean, this is what I love about my work. Like, I walk upstairs to my office, and I'll often, you know, look right down the hall, and somebody like Ru'a or her mom or Wafa will be standing in front of a group. And I remember when I first saw them, and here they are, like, you know, when I first met them, they, same thing, could barely make eye contact, and now they're standing confidently in front of others and you know, helping others. So where was I? Usually when I do these talks in the past, I've highlighted, you know, I like to highlight people's stories, and I'm happy to say many more, but these are the two I have for tonight. But in the past, I would often highlight stories of struggle and, you know, the great hardships that people have and the challenges that they face living as refugees in Jordan. And it's true, like, people live lives of struggle every day. And that's the case for nearly everyone in our community. But what I really see now, and this is something that has really been growing over the past few years, is that there are so many, many people at CRP who have been helped in their most desperate moments through our emergency assistance program, through food vouchers or whatever. And now we've brought them on as staff members in an under-the-radar way, since technically they shouldn't be working, or volunteering as community leaders. And that's what, you know, people come to us and they say, you know, I would love to lead a class. You know, I taught a computer class in Iraq, and I know you have computer classes. Can I teach? Or I'd like to volunteer in our after-school program. Very, very common. They're doing this with great joy and a great sense of purpose, in spite of having lost so much. And, you know, I can't tell you how many refugees we have who are now volunteering with us, because those numbers are growing every day. And that's truly what's special about what we're doing. So in spite of the challenges that these refugees face and the uncertainty of their future, our community has become amazingly resilient and empowered. So we're learning that by giving refugees opportunities to heal, by giving back and helping others, that we've been quietly starting to transform our community and finding out that it's more resilient than we ever could have imagined. I could go on and on showing you pictures of people who are volunteering for us, or refugees who are now working for us, who are on the front lines going into families' homes and assessing them. I'll show you a few. This is Marwan, who is an Iraqi. He's now working with us, and he's with our teen group on a field trip. These are some of our Syrian and Iraqi women who are assessing and doing home visits for refugees who come requesting assistance. This is a group of Sudanese, and Ziad, one of our staff members, going out to give food vouchers to Sudanese. And Mahmoud, one of our teenage, we have a really vibrant teen group, and a lot of these kids are really active in volunteering and leading out and mentoring the kids in our after-school club. So yeah, at CRP, we are giving refugees what they need. We're giving them food. We're giving them basic assistance. But what I see as most important is that we're giving them what they really need. And these are those empowering moments that begin to dislodge a cycle for them. You know, they've come, they've experienced so much trauma, but they're getting something extra. And whether it's to feel free or to sense the power that they have to help themselves in some way, or just to be offered a moment in time where their world that's spinning out of control just stops for a moment and starts to spin in the other direction. And they might not, you know, be thinking, oh, I'm a refugee, this is how I'm identified. You know, just that moment. This work is so much more nuanced and it's so much more complex, but because our community trusts us, because we know them well, we are finding that we're able to do it and that it's something that is the most meaningful thing about what we're doing. We see it as harnessing the intentions of our community to empower them with a way to envision a better future for themselves. And so we're building a future for these people, even in the uncertainty that we have, and even as war and conflict continue to rage on. So war costs a fortune, right? But I want to give you an idea about how scrappy we are as an organization, to how far we stretch funds. You know, we're putting food on people's tables. To give you an example, we're working very, very effectively on a minimal budget. So to give you an example, feeding a person for a week in Jordan cost us $7. And nearly every one of our community center activities is costing us like $100 or less. So we're able to do so much with so little. And a lot of it is because of the very close, I think, knowledge that we have of the community, trust, as well as so many volunteers that are enabling this to happen. Here's one more picture from, I think this is an English class. 8 years of the Syrian refugee crisis is a really long time. And so for us, our biggest challenge, as we're way into this, is that international organizations are able to help less and less. International support continues to dwindle. And as a result, every day I park my car and I walk into my office and I have to walk through at least 50 or 60 people who have recently been taken off of, for example, UN monthly assistance. This is the new thing where we have always been catching people who are falling through the cracks. And these are people who are desperate for help. They don't know how they're going to pay for their rent. They don't know how they're going to get food on their tables. We're also seeing lots more refugees from other nationalities. So like I mentioned, the Yemenis, the Somalis, and the Sudanese. And in those communities, we're seeing malnutrition like we've never seen before. And we find them living in housing that's really just substandard beyond belief. We plan to continue to grow We want to grow our work to help as many people as we possibly can. And I know that as we do, we're going to continue to see people transform before our eyes as they learn ways to take care of their emotional health and through serving others as part of our dynamic community. That's what's been so amazing. You know, you often think, my gosh, these people have nothing. They're struggling. You know, their lives are so difficult. But yet, they want to give back, and they're getting so much out of it. It's such a key part of how they're becoming resilient. The crisis continues on. We have no idea what the future holds for refugees in Jordan, but I do know that Collateral Repair Project is changing individuals' lives for the better, especially in this world that we're living in that often feels like it's just messed up beyond hope. We're giving hope and we're giving healing one life at a time. And sometimes I think the numbers feel so big, but just the fact that, you know, I get to see this every day is wonderful. Before I close, I just think it's so important to just mention that, you know, these people are just like you and me. Most of them live lives of comfort and ease just like us until one day something happened and everything was changed. All they want to do, like all of us, is to take care of their families, make sure that their kids are safe. And despite their many challenges, every day I see people who are benefiting from our holistic approach, people who are able to get food on their table, their stress is kind of freed up, they're able to get into our center and begin building community, healing, and giving back. And I just feel so grateful that, you know, I get to see this every day. I love going to work every day. It's a super happy place. That's what I want you to know. There's so much that can be done through community, and I'm seeing it every day at work. So thanks for listening, and I'm happy to take any questions. I was told by Eric to mention that we'd like to take questions from the mic so that they can have it as part of the recording as well. So feel free to line up if you have any questions.
Hi, that was wonderful. That was really, really powerful. I have a question about what we can do here to help Collateral Repair Project specifically. Mm-hmm. Are there specific things we can do on this side of the
There are so
world?
Many things. It's hard because I'm in Jordan and I struggle to really reach out and let people know. I mean, I feel like these stories, are so important that people hear how we're working, what we're doing. We are always looking for people to like our Facebook page, to share our post, those kinds of things. Those are like easy no-brainers, particularly because we're funded mainly by individual donors. Around 70% of our funding last year came in from individual donors or monthly donors who gave us, you know, anywhere from $10, $15 to, you know, a few hundred dollars a month. Getting the word out is huge for us because we're not able to getting grants. People, you know, funders, foundations don't want to give money to feed people. So we rely on individuals and people giving monthly to be able to feed people. I was going to mention also social media is huge for us because we're in Jordan. Our outreach is through social media. I don't know if you guys are aware about Facebook and their new horrible algorithm that seems to prioritize people's kind of friendships and personal posts, but they're not prioritizing foundations or organizations or things like that. So we have in the past, like since December, seen our audience, people regularly seeing our post by about 90%. So our funding and getting the word out is quite a challenge for us. Those are very easy things, you know, liking our page, sharing a post, commenting on a post. We figured out that that's a kind of a good way to game the system. Yeah, thanks for the question.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I have a few interrelated questions. You mentioned that the Jordanian system prioritizes Syrian refugees. Can you please talk more about how that occurs and why that occurs? And in terms of your organization, how does your assistance change based on the refugee's national origin? And related to that, what sorts of different challenges are you seeing people from different countries having? Like, what are some more common challenges for each region and country?
Oh my gosh, I think we have to stop there for a minute because I'm going to forget if you're asking more. Let me speak to those. First question was prioritizing Syrians, right?
Yes.
Okay. You know, the Syrian refugee numbers are huge and got much more international attention from donors, from large organizations. So the funding has, just kind of largely went to the Syrian population. At the time when Syrian refugees started coming in to Jordan, there was already a somewhat long-term Iraqi refugee situation. And so it's just part of kind of the funding cycle and the way that those shift based on what refugee populations are in need. You asked, your question was about the Jordanian government, and that really doesn't apply to the Jordanian government because the Jordanian government is essentially hosting, but not funding these initiatives. The funding is coming from donor countries around the world, giving mostly via the UN, and then larger international organizations that are coming in with their own kind of, missions and plans. And I've already forgotten your second question, I'm sorry to say.
How does assistance change
based on nationality? Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it actually has not hugely for us recently. We have been very small and we've been growing quite steadily in the past, in the past 5 years. But because we were running on such a shoestring, we really decided to prioritize food security. As we are starting to have more funding and have more staff capacity, we're moving to more of a case management. We've always prioritized, we looked at, okay, we give food vouchers, that's what we do. We don't give cash, we don't have that kind of money. As we begin to grow and have more staff and can handle larger, just larger funds and things like that, we're starting to look at medical needs, legal needs, protection needs and things like that. But it varies. I wouldn't say that any particular national group has one area that we prioritize. I mean, across the board, there are refugees who struggle to make ends meet and don't have an income and, need to be able to pay rent and stuff like that. A lot of mental health issues, stress, depression, trauma, that kind of stuff. So it's quite similar across the board.
Okay. Thank you for that. So my follow-up questions are regarding the food vouchers. How does the food voucher program work? In terms of how does that interact with the local economy? How are people using different vouchers?
So we are giving people vouchers. We're not giving people cash. They can take a voucher. They can go. We have a local supermarket close to the center where we are, where the vast majority of the refugees we serve are living. They can go and they can shop throughout the month for what they need. It's kind of great because we're putting money into the local economy doing that. We also are helping a Sudanese population. So we're actually getting ready to open a center to reach the Sudanese, Somalis, and Yemenis. We've realized that nobody is serving them at all. And they're too far away that they can't get to our center. So we have another grocery store in their neighborhood, but we will soon also be opening another center to be able to reach them. And the same approach that we have many, we're going to start smaller, but most of the same activities that we have at our current center.
Okay, thank you. And my other question is, about the Sudanese and Somali refugees. So can you talk a little bit about the slavery that's happening in Jordan regarding African immigrants? And how are you helping these immigrants who are in slave-like conditions?
I don't know a whole lot about slavery. I think we find that
or indentured servants, basically.
I don't know a lot about that, actually. And I'd be interested in talking to you after to know a little bit more about what you know. This is kind of a work in progress for us. We have been giving food support to particularly Sudanese for the past 2 years. And now as we begin in planning to open our center, we had done an assessment. We are really surprised at, you know, just how difficult it is for them because they're generally not getting monthly support. We often see like two and three families living in like a two-room apartment. We've realized that we're giving a food voucher to a family and it might be like $50 a month and they're sharing it with other families. So, you know, their nutrition needs are not fully met. I mean, it's very difficult, coupled with quite a bit of racism in Jordan. So kids, you know, mothers tell us that they're not comfortable letting their kids out on the street to play. They're getting bullied and sometimes beaten up. So we're looking at creating a safe space for kids. That's one of our primary things. We don't see the Sudanese actually working a lot. So that's why I'm kind of interested in your take on that. But yeah, I'd love to talk to you more about that.
And my last question is regarding your positionality. Are you American?
Yeah, I am.
How do people interact with you in terms of your national origin, given that, you know, the U.S. has destabilized many of these countries?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have lived in Jordan twice. I lived in Jordan once for 7 years. When I went over with my Jordanian boyfriend, who is now my Jordanian husband. I speak Arabic, and I was kind of surprised to find myself living in the Middle East for 7 years that first time. And then we went back, and that was 7 years ago, we returned. When we went back, this newer Iraq war had started, and so I got interested in getting involved with the Collateral Repair Project primarily because of that. I felt like as an American that I wanted to get involved in helping Iraqi refugees that, you know, our country had been involved in, you know, making their situation untenable. So, it's a good question. I don't know. I don't feel that I have struggles navigating it. But I don't know how I could answer that better. But I do feel that it helps that I speak Arabic. I do feel that it helps that I'm working in a very grassroots way, and that's what I'm comfortable doing. And it's been great. Yes, next.
Cool, thanks for your presentation. It's been really enlightening. My question is, so I was wondering if you could clarify, since you mentioned a lot of these refugees have trouble paying rent, and I know you guys give them food vouchers, but then since they're not able to work legally, how do they overcome other financial challenges of just paying rent, paying for other basic needs?
Right. Yeah, it's tough. Obviously, it's tough. We don't have the money to pay rent for people. It's sadly just not going to happen. What we do see is that it's pretty standard for people to have, say, a relative who lives in another country who might send $100 or $200 every, say, I don't know, 2.5 or 3 months. People are really trying to patch it together and they're struggling. It's very common for people to be behind in rent. It's interesting though, because even while people might be behind in rent, landlords in general are somewhat forgiving. If somebody comes and says, my landlord is threatening to kick me out, then you know, we usually, I'll call up CARE, like CARE International might cover, you know, 2 or 3 months of rent. So, you know, we often refer people or just like try and sort things out for people. But yeah, and people will. It's hard because, you know, if you are a refugee and you're caught working, you run the risk of, you know, being put in jail or being deported back to your home country. You know, it's dicey. And a lot of people, especially people with families, don't want to risk that. I mean, you know, it makes sense. That being said, there are a lot of some kind of, you know, often some little short-term things. Like there are some Iraqis in our community, for example, who help with a catering thing, but it's, you know, it's a one-off, or, you know, it doesn't happen very often. So people are very much trying to patch it together, and yeah, that's how it works in general.
First of all, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
I loved hearing really about the like holistic nature of the programs and particularly the inclusivity. Mm-hmm. But to that, I think kind of had me wondering if you could speak to, and you touched on this a little bit now, but the targeting criteria at assessment stage, and then perhaps whether that vulnerability criteria has shifted over the course of the crisis, or you've had to kind of recalibrate that, mm-hmm. given that you're serving all nationalities.
Right.
And then to that also, now that you're kind of adopting more of a case management system, what the network of partners for referrals are like.
Yeah, we'll say that last
But time. The network of partners for referrals is kind of like, mm-hmm. for you guys.
All of this is kind of in process, this moving to case management, because we really, our capacity, we, you know, up until about a year ago, we struggled with capacity, and we're very much like, all right, let's go. And, you know, for us, it was very important because we, you know, have such a small budget that it was really important to us to spend the time to really identify and make sure that we're helping the people who need it most. So for us, it looks like people come in, they register with us. It used to be that we would have registration days, like a couple times a week. People would come in and we would just be inundated with people, and my staff would be down and, you know, kind of doing a quick minute, you know, like 5-minute assessment on their tablets. It was quite chaotic. Now people can just come to us at any time. We pull in their information. We've started moving. We're really trying to move to be much more data driven. I mean, we have been, but we're now, you know, doing this much better. So we will see people. We've started a new assessment because, like I said, we were really prioritizing food security, and so looking at the vulnerability assessment framework and, you know, the stuff that the UN has in many of the organizations adopted. But now we've started looking at other areas as well in a more in-depth way. So medical stuff, you know, potential family violence, family protection issues, things like that. And so that is all part of, you know, people come in for the 5-minute quickie, you know, it's not really quickie, it's more like 10, 15 minutes, to be honest. But yeah, and then we look and we see, because we have so many people, right? So we want to be sure that, you know, the people that kind of seem to be the most extremely vulnerable from that, we then set up to do a phone call with. We do a phone call, and then if they still kind of rise to the top as extremely vulnerable, then we do a home visit. And we are, you know, just inundated with families that we need to visit in the home. But as we further refine that, we're looking to, you know, we're thinking, okay, well, somebody might actually not necessarily be struggling with food security, but they might have a kid who has asthma, who needs to have drugs every month, or, you know, things like that. So we're starting to look at how, as we have more funds and as we hope to get more funds, how to begin shifting that to be able to more pinpoint and serve people in a more, you know, appropriate way. I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, really okay. Cool. Thank you. Uh-huh. Do you think we can do the last two questions together?
Hi, thank you for coming to speak with us. My question for you is twofold. First of all, related to the previous question, what are your numbers like in terms of at any given time, you know, how many food vouchers are you giving
yeah,
out?
Yeah, right.
Who's coming for programming and how much that shifts? Mm-hmm. And my second question is, you spoke to this idea of, you know, people come into your center, they come out more empowered. You're not necessarily operating in a situation where you're then reintegrating people into society, granted that they are refugees and this might not be what we traditionally consider their society, especially with these limitations on their work. So as people get involved, whether in volunteer ways or, you know, you see these changes that are positive, beneficial to their life, What do next steps look like for them, and what role do you have in that?
Right, yeah, that's a great and very tough question. Let me start with the numbers first. We have over 4,000 refugee families registered with us, and we are seeing between like around 150, 175 unique visits in our center every day. In terms of our assistance, we're giving, like last month, we gave out over 475 families received food vouchers from us. And that's kind of where we're at. I mean, it's just about what kind of funds we have in. Every quarter, we try to bump it up and, you know, bring in the money so that we're able to do that. As to your question about what this means, I mean, I feel it's hard because, you know, I feel like, okay, this is a touchy-feely message, you know? We're, like, helping people, and they're becoming empowered. But, like, in the meantime, they have this very difficult existence, and nobody knows what the future holds. It's a tough one. I don't know. We're trying to hedge our bets is probably not the best way to talk about it. But you know, for example, I did not mention that, you know, I mentioned that refugees in Jordan are largely forbidden by law to work. And, you know, that is the vast majority of refugees are forbidden by law to work. There has been a change in the past few years in which donor countries and the UN have been working with the governments in the primary host countries in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan to get the right for refugees to work. And a few years ago, and I can't remember I'm blanking on the quota number, but I think it was around 40,000 Syrian refugees a few years ago. It was decided that Jordan would be allowed, or that Jordan would grant work permits to up to 40,000 Syrian refugees, only Syrian refugees, important to note that as well. But it had to be in certain sectors. So in manufacturing, in construction, in what was the other? Manufacturing, construction, and agriculture. And sadly, that has, you know, started rolling out, but rolled out in a very, you know, not very impressive way. The numbers are not there. There are not that many people with work permits in Jordan. And yeah, and many of them, like what we've seen is that they've gone just into the refugee camps and pulled people out to go work in kind of substandard manufacturing, you know, places where, you know, there are a number of Chinese and Asian workers who have come in. And, you know, the situation is not, the working conditions are not good. That being said, you know, there's going to be a conference just next month in Brussels to push that forward. And I've seen the position papers and, you know, everybody's pushing for this. The Jordanian government, I think, is very much inclined to help figure this out. But it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while for larger numbers, I think, to be able to, for this to be facilitated for larger numbers. So as I said, hedging our bets, we do vocational training in a number of different things that are somewhat under the radar things, like beautician skills for women and barbering skills for men. We've started like cell phone repair for men. We have a women's craft collective, which isn't so much vocational, but a way for people to have a source of income. I don't know, because really the key is being able to work and to be able to provide for your family. And that's a big question mark still, sadly. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hello, thank you very much for your presentation. You mentioned that you're also offering English classes, and I was working in Turkey with refugees a couple of years ago, and we were also offering English classes, but as we were doing it, we realized that the refugees wouldn't be able to use it in any way, like in the short term, mm-hmm. and also like while struggling with many other things, it was really like a couple of hours a week wouldn't really change much about like they're learning the language. So we realized that it wasn't really useful and applicable in the short term to learn the language, and in the long term they wouldn't be able to remember it. So I was wondering in Jordan, like, what's the utility of teaching English and not maybe add classes like where they could learn other skills which are more applicable in the short term?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. Our English classes are our biggest program at CRP. everybody wants to take English classes. And I've always had kind of mixed feelings about it because I think a lot of people are like, I want to take an English class because I want to get resettled to America or to Canada. And the reality is less than 1% of them are going to be resettled to a third country. However, there's great enthusiasm. People want to learn English. And so when I talk about this whole kind of community that we've built and it's not really about learning English. People are thrilled to be learning skills. They're thrilled, like super thrilled to be learning skills. I've realized that English is an amazing tool for our teens. We have lots of teens who are not in school, and this is a huge challenge for us. But interestingly, they're so interested in learning English. They're interested in learning computers. We're trying to get them to get their basic literacy and numeracy. We got to do that. But it's interesting because even with these kids who have been out of school for years, they have, a lot of them have very basic literacy and numeracy skills. So getting a class together with a bunch of teens to do math, we can't do that. Like, we have to find a better way because they're embarrassed. I mean, to be in a classroom with their, you know, first and second grade math skills or, you know, poor Arabic skills, that's not going to work. But English, we see, is an amazing thing because they all come in and they take English class and they're so into it and they're all starting at the same level. So it's a way for them to start loving learning. And they certainly use it a lot at our center. We have tons of interns and volunteers who come to us who are English speaking. Jordan, there are many ways to be using English in Jordan. But it's interesting because I hear again and again from refugees, oh yeah, I love coming because I'm learning something. And I think when you're not working and you don't have a way to take care of your family, it's a way to feel like you're starting to improve yourself, to make yourself more useful in some way. I don't know. I know that it's very popular, and because people want it so much, we're not going to stop doing it. So, yeah. Thank you all for coming out. It's been a pleasure.